Technology these days, but we'll see how we go today. Let's see what the volume level there, should be all right. Okay, I haven't had a chance to upload them yet because I'm still trying to get everything worked out properly. But I'm going to try embedding this narration in this particular lecture, so it'll be there. It'll be when you read it through again later. Let's get going anyway. The last couple of weeks I've been doing a demolition job on conventional economic theory. I'm going to continue that a bit today, but also start getting on to some more constructive work and showing an alternative way of thinking about how the economy functions, how the financial market functions. So last week I went through how the capital asset pricing model developed theoretically, and then how what we call expected utility analysis was actually quite a distorted application of the work of von Neumann and Morgenstern. Things they specifically told economists not to do, they did in working with it. Then why maximising returns isn't actually rational. This week I'm going to go and show how the data actually destroys the capital asset pricing model. And you might be told by some of the lecturers that it doesn't. They've got to be using rather strange filtering to show a different result of what I'll be showing today, but we'll go through that and take a good look. Now, the capital asset pricing model assumes markets are efficient. And by efficient, what they actually mean is markets accurately predict the future. And I'll show you why that's what it means shortly. But if that was true, prices would follow what they call a random walk with drift. Prices would bounce around largely randomly, and there'd be an increasing trend over time. So they'd drift upwards, bouncing in a random fashion. And the deviations, generally speaking, would follow the normal distribution. There's a range of distributions that are random. The normal, the log normal, and so on, the swan, etc., etc., fit in that category of random processes giving you a distribution which is noise-based rather than based by any deterministic patterns. Generally, the normal distribution is the aggregate of all those. It's the one that gives you if you do enough samples of any particular distribution, the samples will give you a normal distribution if the distribution is random. And given that distribution, huge changes, by which I mean more than plus or minus 5 standard deviations from the mean, will be vanishingly rare. They won't turn up in the data except an absolute fluke, and if they do, you can ignore them because they're such a tiny part of the overall data series, their impact upon the actual aggregate series is trivial. So a lot of econometric work involves filtering out these so-called outliers. Now, the actual data shows that extreme changes in the market are very, very common, and I wouldn't be the least bit surprised to see a few more extreme changes in the next 2 months of this year. So the markets end up not being efficient as economists define the word. They might be efficient still in the sense we actually tend to use it in common parlance. This is one of the many criticisms I have of conventional economics. It uses words that have a particular meaning in ordinary language in a way that's quite distorted by the economic use of it. So I say something efficient, normally I mean odd. Works really well with a minimum of waste and things happen quickly. I don't mean that I can prophesize the future. But that's effectively what the word efficient means in the neoclassical theory. And I'll show you one of the founders of this theory admitting that in a rather roundabout way in a paper published in 2004 when he said, we've got to abandon the theory. Now, what we mean by efficient is obviously market movements in the stock market happen extremely quickly. Now we have these micro trades that are making things happen even more rapidly again. But a key part of the data from the perspective that I've got on the markets is that what other traders do matter. And what you're doing is reacting rapidly to what they're doing. You're not rapidly reacting to news. So there's an internal feedback in the system that makes it extremely volatile and unstable. And that can, at a superficial level, that it can appear to be random noise generated, but it's actually the feedback from traders on each other. And those feedbacks cause dramatic nonlinearities, which conventional economic thinking leaves out because they process out the nonlinear information most of the time, and booms and busts. And clearly we've seen plenty of those so far. Now, the whole efficient market hypothesis includes the capital asset pricing model, and it sees everything as happening in equilibrium. And one of the great fallacies of conventional economic thinking is they seem to think if something's not in equilibrium, then you can't explain what's happening to it. You've got to put it in equilibrium first of all before you can explain how it might move to the next value. That's laughable from the point of view of normal sciences that are used to analysing things out of equilibrium all the time. And in fact, by being in equilibrium, things aren't going to change. So, nonetheless, with this equilibrium orientation and with the argument that the market's efficient to begin with, there were no possibilities for traders to profit. So the argument of why is it so hard to make money in the stock market came down to the argument was that there's no technique you can use because the market contains all the information. If you try to exploit past information using techniques that physics might use, like neural networks, for example, you'd find that there's no information there to be made use of. The shares accurately price everything, so trying to beat the market, you're going to fail. That's the conventional argument. Now, there's an alternative view, and that is the markets are chaotic. There's so much noise, so much volatility inside. They're not noise generated, but generated by the actual process of the markets themselves. That disequilibrium process makes it really easy to make a mistake, even if you have the right model. But if you are cautious about it, intelligent about it, you can make money by exploiting mispricing with a range of techniques that are outside the thinking of conventional economic and econometric thinking. Now, normally they're too complicated to work out. There's actually a marvellous implementation of this called the minority game, which you can find on the web. You can actually go and play it. And it's what the minority game is, an attempt to simulate some of the behaviour of the stock market. Give it a try. See if you can beat the market. So, we have two extremes of how you can look at the volatility and the market information and how difficult it is to make money out of that. One is the argument that it's an efficient market with random change, therefore there's nothing to exploit. The other is it's a highly volatile market, anything but efficient in the economist's sense, and it's too hard to find the information most of the time. Now, if you have a latter type of system, then it's always going to be away from equilibrium. If you have the former, where it's a stable equilibrium system with a bit of noise, the values will always be close to that equilibrium. So there's a very distinct difference in the hypothesis that they're both making about the nature of the data, even though their conclusions about the data are very, very different. So it can be hard to exploit this highly nonlinear process, but the information and the mispricing can still be there. And these systems don't operate near equilibrium, they operate a long, long way from equilibrium. And I know you haven't seen anything so far in your economics that's out of equilibrium. Everything you do involves finding the point of intersection of two lines. It's being slightly dismissive of what you've learnt in economics so far, but you know, where do supply and demand equal each other? Where do aggregate demand and aggregate supply equal each other? It's always finding the point of intersection of two lines. Now, I'm going to show you different methods that exist, where the system is always out of equilibrium, and if you actually try to model it by saying, let's work out the equilibrium of the system and then see what's going to happen there, the answer is nothing happens there. The system never gets anywhere near the equilibrium. And the best example to show you this is a model of the weather developed by a guy called Lorenz back in the early 60s. And what Lorenz was trying to do was to explain the volatility we see in the weather system. Did any of you see that storm a couple of days ago, that bizarre storm spreading across Sydney? Okay. That's chaos. Okay. Now, he was trying to explain that level of volatility. And he built a model of fluid flow, working from accepted equations of how fluids do flow under pressure and heat in a tube, and taking what's called a second-order Taylor series expansion of that. And the basic idea was that fluid flow is caused by heat differences. So if you look at convection in a fluid, and the storm you saw in Sydney on Monday was one example of convection. Was it Monday or Sunday?
Sunday.
Convection in a fluid. Another might be just putting a pot of water on the stove and watching what happens to it. Now, the stove's probably the best example because you actually can visualise what's happening there. You have rising and falling columns of fluid. When you put the pot on the stove and turn the temperature on, the heat on the bottom causes some of the water to rise. But equally, some of the water has to fall, because if it didn't, the whole thing would explode out of the pot. Okay? So it bubbles, but it continues rotating. There has to be rising and falling columns of water in that pot. That gives you turbulence. You think about it, do it back at home, it's quite a bit of fun to watch. Put a pot of cold water on the stove, put it on, put the heat on high, and watch what happens and see what starts to develop. So you get turbulence in the system, circulating air, circulating fluid, rising and falling columns. And one of the best examples is what's happening in the Earth's core. We tend to forget that we're standing on a liquid planet. We're standing on the very thin crust of a liquid planet about, you know, about 8,000 kilometres in depth. And if you look at it, that's what it looks like. This is taking the core of the planet and then wrapping it around. Down in the middle of the planet, we have this huge core of nickel iron. And that, under extreme pressure and heat, caused partly by radiation, That core generates enormous amounts of heat, which then means the magma, the fluid that causes the volcanic explosions we see on the newspapers. Has anybody seen an active volcano? Yep. Whereabouts? In Kenya. Kilimanjaro? Was that not active anymore? Another one. Okay. Yeah, I flew over one in Hawaii this year. It's quite a bit of fun. As long as it doesn't explode on you. So what's actually happening in that volcano is there's heat generated around the core. This is wrapping out the core. The actual circumference of that iron core is about 9,000 kilometres. Just imagine the outside of this huge ball of iron in the heart of the planet. And this generates, heat will come off that and cause, in some particular point, it will cause a fluid flow to begin. And it sustains it over a long period of time. When it gets to the top, that's what gives us, pushes apart the plates the planet floats on, the tectonic plates we're all standing on. And it's also, when it gets through to the surface, that's what causes a volcano. But of course, as it's going up, you get a rising column of hot magma, which gets to the surface. Of course, when it reaches the surface, it cools down. And it then has, for the Earth not to explode, that column has to fall back down again somewhere further away. And you can measure how close they are at the top. They're going to be very close together at the top because the column that's going up becomes the column that's coming down after it cools down. Down at the bottom, they're going to be far away. So there's a couple of metrics. The heat difference between the top and the bottom, the gap between the top and the bottom. And Lorentz built what you might call a simple mathematical model of that, which had just three variables and three parameters. So the variables are x, y, and z. The parameters, which are constants, are just a, b, and c. That's pretty hard to imagine a simpler model of something as complex as that, or just imagine the pot of water on your stove. This is exactly what you'd see in the stove, by the way, because the base is going to be flat. So you could actually do the same sort of thing with your stove and check it out later. And the three variables are the intensity of convection, so how fast that thing is turning over, how fast the hot to cold is rotating. The temperature gap between the rising and falling columns measured at some point, so how much difference in temperature is there between the rising and the falling column, and how much that profile across the gap deviates from a straight line. So that's a rather strange measure. The idea is you might find it's hot all the way out and then suddenly becomes cold, or it gets hot to cold and then flattens out, or just a straight smooth line from the hot to the cold. Those three measures. So let's take a look at that same piece of data about the magma now. And there are the equations, the dx dt. Now notice that there's dt there, which means rate of change with respect to time. Now I don't know how many times you've seen an equation including time in it in economics, where the process is changing over time. You should be seeing it all the time because the economy is always moving. There's no such thing as a static economy. It's an invention of our mind to talk about y rather than y of t, and to talk about equilibrium output, y of t, rather than equilibrium rate of change of output, dy dt, what we should be doing. But that's why I've got c inside those equations. So that's the rates of change of those three variables, x, y, and z. And there you've got the relationship for the rate of change of the intensity of convection from top to bottom, the rate of change of temperature from top to bottom, and the non-linearity of the profile between the two segments. How much does it move apart? What's the sort of shape look like? Now, it looks pretty simple. If you look at that, most students would think, what would you do next with that set of equations? How about work out the equilibrium? That'd be a standard economic approach. Let's do that. Three equations, three parameters, can't be all that hard. Let's work it through. And it's a semi-quadratic, by the way. This is the important thing. It's non-linear. Essentially non-linear, because you'll notice here, this has, the second equation has z multiplied by x. So two of the variables are being multiplied together. And the bottom equation is x multiplied by y. So there's two points in the equation where it's like a quadratic. X squared, only it's x times y, y times z. Now, let's work that equilibrium out. So the trick to do is say, how do you reckon you'd find the equilibrium? I've actually sold you there. You set all the dx dt is to zero and see what you get. There's dx dt, dy dt, and z dt are all equal to zero. And now what you've got is a set of quadratics and linear equations. And you can therefore solve the values for them. Let's go through the first one. Well, the obvious thing for the first one is that you set x and y equal to each other. You set dx dt equals a times y minus x. And if y equals x, the answer is zero. No change. So one of the solutions is y equals x. Okay? The second, we now put that into the second equation, so I've got x equal y in the second equation, and let's solve that. We have b minus z times x minus y equals 0. Well, I can now substitute x for the y and say b minus z times y minus y is equal to 0. Then I rearrange it, and I put the y's on either side and then divide through by y. So I get the result that b minus z equals 1. Therefore, an equilibrium value for z is equal to b minus 1. Okay? Third step. For the third equation, I've got x equal to y. I can substitute that back in again. And I now know what z's equal to. So I'm going to substitute those values in and see what I get. And I get y squared minus c times b minus 1 is equal to 0. So therefore, y squared is equal to c times b minus 1. And therefore, y has two values, either plus or minus the square root of c times b minus 1. Pretty straightforward? Yeah.
What happened to x on that? It's not x.
See, x, because I already know that x, that y and x are the same, exactly the same solution apply for x. Okay? So where y is plus the square root, x is also plus the square root, when y, x, you know, the other way around. And another solution as well, if you take a look at it, is also that all the variables are equal to 0. So, bummer, we have not one equilibrium, not two, but three. So what do you reckon you do next? Find the stable one? That's what Lorenz thought as well when he first had a look at it. The trouble is, there is no stable solution. For some parameter values, you can get a stable equilibrium. But for most realistic values, putting in values that actually make sense in terms of convection and so on, all those three equilibria are unstable. When you take a look at it, I could take you through matrix mathematics proof of that, but you get three unstable equilibria. What the hell's going to happen then? It can't be an equilibrium unless it starts there. If it starts in any of the three equilibrium, it'll move away. So what on earth does it do? Well, to find out, you have to simulate. And this is how we discovered chaos empirically in the 1960s. We actually discovered it theoretically in 1899, a long time ago, before we could actually conceptualize it with computer simulations. But Lorenz discovered chaos by accident, first of all by deriving this model, and then secondly by having an old-fashioned, well, a 1960s computer, which had less power than probably most of your wristwatches, and asking, the computer worked at 6 decimal places of accuracy. But the printer worked at 4 decimal places of accuracy. So he did a run, and he got this really strange result, really strange, and he gave it back to his research assistant and said, rerun it. So the research assistant went back to the lab with the 4 digits and typed them in and ran it again and got a completely different result. He left off 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 6, which in a normal system you can ignore things that small, they're trivial, they're going to disappear, and got a totally different result. Now, that was where we learnt what's called the sensitive dependence upon initial conditions and a whole range of things that became part of what's now called complexity theory. And back in those days, you had to write a very complicated COBOL program to be able to see the stuff yourself, or Fortran program. Now there's plenty of programs that'll do it. But the basic idea of the programs these days, and I'm going to be giving you one in this course, and which is you can play with yourselves, and another program which you can actually simulate models that I'll give you anyway. But they represent the system as a flowchart. So I have a set of equations, and you iterate from an initial value through a flowchart, and the flowchart does the mathematics for you. And you see what happens over time. So here's Lorenz's system. Unfortunately, this won't turn up in the embedded system here. And what I've got is his three equations done there using flowcharts. I'll explain the logic later, but you can see, for example, that little block there's got a multiplied by symbol. You know, it's the asterisk for multiplied by. There's a summation symbol. And there's an integration symbol. I'll take you through all those details later. Anyway, he simulated the system, and this is what he saw. Have you heard the expression about how a butterfly flapping its wings in South America can cause a cyclone in Asia? That's where the idea came from, because that looks like a butterfly. That's why the nickname developed. You notice that there are three equilibria, as I showed you beforehand. There's the 0, 0, 0 equilibria right in the middle. And notice what's happening. The system will approach it and then get repelled away. It never reaches that equilibrium point. Then there's the negative equilibrium, and that's the positive equilibrium. And notice nothing's happening there. The system never gets anywhere near them. So if you tried to analyse this as an equilibrium system, you'd be wasting your time. If you told everybody what happens in the equilibrium, you'd be telling them what never happens in the weather. You wouldn't last long on Channel 7, I hope. Let's go back and carry on from there, having shown it to you. So how do you actually work this out? I'm going to go back to the software package now and talk about how those software packages work. And the idea is you take a variable like, for example, population, and you multiply that value, the current value, by its growth rate. So the Australian population right now is about 22.5 million. Its growth rate is about 1.8%. So I multiply it by 1 plus that percentage rate of growth, and I've got some idea of what the population is going to be next year. But I'm doing this in continuous time, so rather than doing that 1 plus thing, I multiply it by its current rate of change and integrate that over time, which is adding up the small increments that occur. Add that to the initial population, and then I can predict very smoothly what future population is going to be. That's an example of it there. So here we have an equation for population. And what happens is, there's population. I multiply that, there's the multiply symbol, by the growth rate for population. I then integrate that. That is doing a numerical version of the symbolic integration you guys have done in maths courses. I then add that to its original population, population in 2009. That's the addition sign for that. And I end up with a population prediction for the future. That's the basic logic. It's really cool stuff. And believe me, you can design some pretty sophisticated systems using this software. This is just the absolutely simplest model you can do. And I've got a simulation of it there if you want to give that a play later. And at this particular slide, I've embedded a free copy of the simulation software. You can actually load it yourself and play it back at home and see what happens. Now, this is Lorenz's equations in math, in VizSim. And when you simulate it, as I've shown you, that's the sort of result you get. We're seeing it running in the background here. Okay. Now, it's never in equilibrium. It follows complex cycles, and those cycles, unlike most cycles you've been used to, you can't predict them. If you know a sine wave, you can say exactly what the sine wave is going to be in a million years' time, if the frequency doesn't change and the amplitude doesn't change. But these are aperiodic. It will cycle, but the length of the cycle and the amplitude will never be repeated. So any particular cycle you now know won't be the same as the next cycle. But that sounds pretty chaotic, and that's where the word chaos first came from. When Lorenz first looked at it, what he actually saw was effectively a printout of the bottom graph down here. You can see the bouncing around that's going there. Now, what I'm showing you, the one up the top, is plotting one variable against another. And then you've got that. Now, you'd never imagine that something as messy as that time series actually has that beautiful structure beneath it, but literally, those are the two. So there's structure behind that chaos, and now the popular word has become not chaos theory, but complexity theory, to try to explain where those complex patterns come from. It's a marvellous area of science, which economics almost completely missed out on. In fact, there's actually a guy who would have been professor here, could have been professor some years ago, and he made the mistake in his interview of saying to me that he thought chaos theory hadn't amounted to much. And that was one reason I voted against him on the committee, because he obviously didn't read outside economics. Now, that gives you an explanation for the turbulent weather system. That's a photograph of a cyclone over Florida. And when you take a look at what's actually going on, you've got a very similar process going on inside that cyclone to what you have in terms of in the stove and the Earth's magma and so on. So most of the important things that matter to us on this planet are non-equilibrium processes, and that includes the stock market. So, initially, there was a person working in economics who thought so, a guy called a mathematician, a French mathematician, Bernard Mandelbrot. Has anybody heard the name Mandelbrot? Have you heard of a Mandelbrot set? Okay, when you get back home, Google Mandelbrot set, and you'll see one of the most beautiful structures ever discovered. And Bernie's responsible for finding that out. But he thought if markets were efficient, then they'd affect all this available information. He said, that doesn't seem to happen. It's not what's going to happen. He said, if it was true, you'd have a Gaussian pattern. You'd have a random pattern turning up. And instead, he found something quite structured in the prices of cotton. And he published a paper on cotton, which he thought would have a big impact on economics, and it was completely ignored. So he gave up on economics and went across to geography for quite a while, developed a whole range of ideas in geography, and then came back to economics later in life. We could have had Mandelbrot stuff 40 years ago, because he began talking in economics, but economists ignored him and went with the Gaussian stuff instead. Now, Gaussian distributions result from a process which is inherently random, as I showed you last week, in a toss of a coin, all that sort of jazz. In the limit, if you do them often enough, then you can describe the outcome by the average outcome plus the standard deviation. Now, of course, in some more complicated distributions, there'll be a kurtosis and a skew and other things like that, but pretty much those two numbers describe the whole scene. And 68% of what's going to happen will be within one standard deviation, 95% within two, 99.7 within three, and you can pretty much ignore the rest because it's such a tiny part of the whole system. Let's look at the height of American males in that sense. The average is 178 centimetres. The standard deviation is 8 centimetres. And there's roughly 150 million of them. So the height distribution should and does look like this graph. Very, very few who are less than 140, well, almost none less than 140 centimetres tall. Almost none more than 2.2 metres. And this huge hump in the middle for the average male. Now, if you rank them from the shortest to the tallest, you get this sort of distribution. Again, almost nobody below 150 centimetres in height, almost nobody above 210, anybody that is playing in the National Basketball League. So the vast majority, more than 120 over 150, lie between 170 centimetres and 190 centimetres tall. There's only a tiny fraction, which is taller than 2 metres, which is 2.75, standard deviations above the mean, or shorter than 160. If you see anybody that tall, you really look at them, okay? They're unusual to be that tall, or that short. So here again, another way to look at it, going from the percent of the males who are above a certain height. And as you can see, virtually 100% are above 140 centimetres tall. That's now looking in terms of standard deviations. When you get up to four standard deviations, you're basically talking zero who are going to be that small. There are some. There are, you know, people who want whatever they call dwarfism these days. I'm sure that's a politically incorrect term, but I'll have to use it right now. Okay, there's a fraction who are that small. Now, if the stock market was behaving the same way, it'd look the same. You could characterise it using an average daily movement and a standard deviation, and that'd tell you all you really needed to know. And 68% of what happened to be between one plus and minus one standard deviation, 95% within two, etc., etc. Well, let's take another look at the stock market, a bit like last week's. The average for the Dow Jones from 1914 to last year was a 0.27% movement on a daily basis. Now, how often do you see movement that small? It's actually remarkable when there is that one small. Part of the reason why is the standard deviation is enormous compared to the mean. 1.136% per day. And I'm using a reasonably good sample, 224,437 trading days. So the market should look something like this. I'm taking that information and generating a simulated data plot, which has a mean and standard deviation with that many data points in it. And that's what the Dow Jones should look like in terms of daily movements. And if I sort it from tallest to biggest, smallest to biggest movements, then I should get something like this. And this is actually taking that simulated data and sorting it. Looks much the same as the American information, the height information I showed you beforehand. What's the actual data look like? Well, at a first glance, and this is how economists can fool themselves in this sort of stuff, it doesn't look too different. When you plot it, you get the red line is the simulated data, the blue is the actual. There's a deviation, but you know, it doesn't look too bad. Notice there are lots of blue points further out though. So how much longer is that data series compared to, because there are more events at either end of the system, in effect there's more movements in the real data than you get in the simulated data. How many? Well, I'm going to, notice I've got down the bottom, I'm limited to the minus six standard deviations in one direction, plus six in the other. I'm going to remove those limits and take another look. And I'm going to use the log of the percentage scale. rather than using a straight percentage scale. And this is what you get. Whoops. There's a pretty big gap now, isn't there? The actual data has daily movements that are far larger than you'll get out of the normal distribution. 22%. That's more than 20 standard deviations in one day. And there are many more positive events too. There have been movements in the stock market up as much as 15% in one day. Now, to a standard linear econometrician, those are outliers. To somebody who understands what's going on in the market, that's the market's actual behaviour. There's a dynamic there, both to exploit and to be very, very scared about too. Now, the many, many more negatives, what I'm going to do here is re-rank it from the smallest to the biggest in magnitude and see what I get. And equally, you get an enormous gap between simulated data and the actual data in terms of the magnitude of movements. So this is just restricting it just to around that the mean. You can see the red line is actually very, very narrow. The red line's only got a small amount of the graphic itself. The blue line goes from one side of it to the other. So clearly, the simulated data, based on the presumption that the data is random, looks nothing like the actual data. So what does it mean? Let's take a good look. There's 24,500 points inside there. The random movement says there are going to be very, very narrow range of movements there. When you take a look at how many movements there are there, it's an extremely short plot of how many movements there can be. That's the gap for the random, from the biggest to the smallest movement, largest up to largest down. A pretty small range. That's the actual data range, far larger. Now, are you just ignoring a few outliers that you can forget about? No, if you actually count up how big those outliers are, a 22% movement in the stock market one day is a pretty silly thing to ignore. You're going to be out of business. So you get an argument that's only going to be, from the random model, it's saying there'll be one movement of 4.46% with the particular simulation I ran, or worse. And there are actually 400 such movements. There's this prediction. One such movement in the last century. There are actually 100 days that has falls larger than that. Up you go. Read that across the side one. 100 such days. So it's wrong by a factor of 100. That's a pretty bad mistake. I think you'd be failed in any exam where you got one out of 100. So the volatility has been drastically underestimated. This is ranking the movements from the biggest to the smallest in the actual stock market over the last century. And the worst one there is minus 22.61% in one day on the 19th of October 1987. This is ranking the random data I've simulated in the same period. And the worst you get out of the random data is minus 4.46. Now, the actual falls in the market, the top 100 falls, are all bigger than the very biggest prediction you get from the random market information. And there's also lots of clustering going on the actual data. The first set of points there are all from the 1930s. A couple of different days, then back to the 1930s again. A few different days and back to the 1930s again. Then 1930s again. 1987, of course, I've got sticking out like a sore thumb at the very top of the list. They're very evenly distributed here. Just to read off the first few days, you get, for the random distribution, you get 1917, 30, 12, 5, 20, 11, 3, 23, 29, 16. A bit of clustering. You're not seeing many from late in the century there. But I have hard memory of the dates. No, 94, 41, 73, 56, 17, 24, 87, 79. Sounds like I'm reading out of lots of games at a lotto. So it's totally random in one side, very, very structured, both in terms of scale and clustering at the time these things happen too in the market. Now, you're told by the efficient markets hypothesis you can't predict it. It's all random movements, starting martingales, blah 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 blah. The distribution you're seeing in the stock market is actually called a fractal distribution. And that comes back to Bernie Mandelbrot. If you search for the word fractal, you'll find he originated the concept. And you, in a fractal distribution, you have many, many more events in the periphery, the extremes, that they call the fat tail. And the extreme events are extremely likely. In fact, with a proper fractal distribution, the variance, you can work out a standard deviation given the actual data set you've got. That's what I've done for the Dow Jones. But strictly speaking, the variance for a true chaotic fractal distribution is infinite. So any scale of event can occur. Now, if compare that to a Gaussian, where there's a cutoff in how extreme the events can be, the odds of a 5% fall in the Dow Jones, according to that distribution, were it strictly Gaussian, I'm sure econometrician would say log normal or something would be slightly different. But the odds of a 5% fall would be less than 2 in a million. How long would you need to wait to see that 1%, what that 1-5% fall, according to the Gaussian prediction? 2,500 years. There would have been one such fall since the establishment of Rome. There's another distribution called the power law, and I'll take you through that to some extent in this course. And that's very, very different. And it basically says the number of events of a particular size will be roughly equal to that same size raised to a power. Now, that sounds a bit strange. It was actually originated by an economist, Pareto, Wilfredo Pareto, who was actually an engineer initially, looked at a distribution of the income of wealth and found the equation worked for wealth distributions as well. So what he's saying, the number of people whose income is the size of X is roughly equal to 1 over X raised to some power. And that seemed to be a fairly reasonable prediction of the scale of income between the poorest and the wealthiest in society. Now, the outcome of that particular relationship is that when you take a log of both sides of the equation, you get a straight line relationship. So if I take the log of n of x, that's going to be equal to the log of x raised to the power of minus a, and that'll be equal to minus alpha times the log of x. I've left off a constant in that particular equation. So it's saying the log of the number of events of a particular size will be roughly equal to minus alpha times that the log of that size. And it applies to an incredible range of actual phenomena. Earthquakes, for example, are very closely fitted by that particular distribution. How about the stock market? Let's take a look. Here's a power law fit to the Dow Jones. And the value I found for alpha in doing this is minus 3.96. So I'm saying the log of the number of events of a particular scale, whether it be a 1% movement or a 2% movement or a 10% movement, take the log of that percentage movement, will be roughly minus 3.96 times the log of that percentage. The dotted lines of the data aggregated into ranges of movement, the straight line is the plot prediction. Pretty damn close. Now, minus 1 there means 10 to the minus 1 or a 10% change in one day. 1 on the other axis means 10 to the 1 or 10 such events per century. So let's take a look at it and see what the model predicts. It's saying here that there'll be, according to the power law, the prediction is that there'll be, I think, 6 such events. A lot more than the Gaussian prediction would argue. It said 1 every 2,500 years. This thing says 6 in the last century. The actual number was 8. So it's pretty accurate. Accuracy alone is a good reason to say there's something important going on here. Now, what does it tell us if we don't get out of the Gaussian argument, the efficient market hypothesis? Well, a hell of a lot. Here's doing exactly the same thing with both the power law and a Gaussian distribution's predictions plotted. On the green line is the Gaussian. And they can see what's happening. It's saying extreme movements are vanishingly rare. It's okay as it happens for a small range. If you restrict yourself to plus and minus 3 standard deviations around the mean, which is what most linear tests will do, they'll filter out the extreme stuff, then you get 780 movements in that range of three standard deviations versus a prediction of 718. Now, when you get to larger levels, it's hopeless because the theory says, what's the chance of a movement of the magnitude of 6%? It says 1, there are 57 such movements. What about the possibility of an 8% movement? It says 1 in a million. You need a million centuries to get a movement that big. Okay. That's a fair while. In fact, you get a hell of a lot more than that in the actual data. 11 turn up. But let's just follow through. There's minus 1.2, that means 10 to the power of minus 1.2 on the bottom axis, or a 6% daily movement. You come across to the Gaussian's predictions, it says 10 to the minus 2, okay, that means one such event per century. Actually, that's even worse than that, that's over an entire century. 10 to the minus, 1 over 10, 1 chance in 10, I've got that wrong there, I must fix that later. The actual number is 57. 10 to the minus 1 is an 8% change. The prediction there is 10 to the minus 6. One such event every million centuries. How many were there? 11. Last century.
Isn't it still profitable as big?
Pardon?
When you look at random walking, it's still profitable for hedge fund managers.
To make money, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they're making money by knowing it's not random.
But they still utilize random
walking. The ones who go out of distance do. Ones who stay in business modify it rather drastically. You heard of long-term capital management?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we have a belief system in economics that the system's in equilibrium and changes due to random shocks. Therefore, you have vanishingly rare extreme movements. The actual data is totally different to that. I'll give you another way of looking at it. I'm going to be hammering this home to you because I know you'll be told by other economists that it's actually... you can explain it using a random approach. So let's take a look at the magnitude of events. How many events of plus or minus one standard deviation would you get if it was Gaussian? Well, given that many data points, you get 18,500. There are actually 17,800. That's pretty close. What about two standard deviations, plus or minus either side? 3,818 is the actual number. 3,447 was the Gaussian prediction. 1.1 times, that's pretty close too. 3%, it's also pretty good. When you get to 4%, you start to get a problem. At 4%, the Gaussian prediction is 67 such movements. There are 250 of them, so it's out by a factor of 4. You get to 5%, predicting about 2.5 movements. There are 106 of them, out by a factor of 38. 6%, one every 20 centuries. In fact, there are 57, out by a factor of 1,000. Then it's a factor by 53,000, then a factor of 7 million, and then it's out by scales of billions times wrong in the frequency of the events that actually occur. That's how wrong it is. So the daily movements could be any size at all. And that's why people were comforted by saying, well, at least there'll never be a crash, of 10% in one day like there was back in 1929. They were right. The next big one was 22%. That's not predicting there'll be a bigger one yet to come in the future. But you cannot rule out extreme events in a system which obeys a power law distribution rather than a Gaussian one. So crashes aren't aberrations, they're the normal behaviour of the system. If you don't understand crashes as well as spikes, you don't understand the system at all. In fact, what you're studying is not the system but the noise, in effect, when you leave out those extreme events. Another way of looking at it, that's the same data graphed. You can see how extreme the differences get to be away from the middle. It's okay in the middle. If you filter it out and remove your outliers, it looks fine. Again, the same sort of story. Now, this particular one is a common way of just showing the difference between the actual distribution and the Gaussian prediction. I don't think it actually gives you a good enough idea. It loses that information at the extreme. So I've turned it upside down and said, how much of a gap is there? How wrong is the system on a log scale? So at the end of the scale there is where you've got a movement of more than 7 standard deviations, or 7% down, which is less than 7 standard deviations, it's wrong by a factor of 10 million. In the middle, it's right between minus 3 and plus 3. So there's an enormous difference between seeing it as a random process and seeing it as one that's to some extent deterministic, but subject to shocks as well. So there's some sort of partly deterministic process going on there in the stock market. And if you can work out what it is, even though it's highly nonlinear, you can make money out of it. But you can also say that it's extremely dangerous. Anything that moves around by 22 standard deviations in a day is not to be trusted. And there's all sorts of things to be there. Bull versus bear positions people take with each other. Short squeezes and stuff like that affecting the market. and the underlying feedback from the financial system as well. So we need a theory that captures that. That happens to be a theory of endogenous money, and I'll take you into that in the next few weeks, and a theory of finance which is non-linear and non-equilibrium. And physicists are developing that. If you actually go to Science Direct and search for a journal called Physica A, there's actually five Physica journals, Physica A, B, C, D, and E. Physica A is a journal of interdisciplinary physics. You'll find lots of papers published there on the nature of the stock market from this perspective. And anybody who publishes a paper saying it's Gaussian, they get laughed out by the referees, who, by the way, have got mathematics that runs rings around economists, and the usual argument economists use to say why people criticise neoclassical theories, they don't have the mathematics. I pity any economist who says that to a physicist. Their training is far, far tighter in mathematics than economists have. So if it's so obviously wrong, why do economists still cling to it? We'll get onto that and an alternative in the next half of the lecture. I'll take a bit of a break. Thank you. Thank you.